hoping by the end of my talk that you'll know the names of six or seven other people who are better qualified to introduce Owen Barfield, but I'm the one who's here tonight. This is a topic that when I was originally contacted by one of your former colleagues who's no longer here at UT, Bill McClay, who invited me to give this lecture, I asked whether C.S. Lewis, whether Lewis's work was part of the job description, and I've given quite a few lectures talking about Lewis's work, and I thought, well, what could I do that would challenge me and give me some new things to read and some new things to think about? And I've been thinking a lot about the nature of imagination and meaning. What does meaning mean? How does meaning mean lately? And I knew that that's something Barfield had addressed, so I thought I would tackle Barfield. It's a big project, and I want to warn you, when you dig into reading his work, it's challenging, and I'll give some idea of the nature of that challenge in the next hour. In the late 1920s, before he converted to Christianity, C.S. Lewis was living in Oxford. He was sharing a house with Janie Moore, the mother of Lewis's friend and fellow cadet, a young man who was killed during the First World War, Paddy Moore. And one day, a young fellow set out to visit Lewis at his house. Am I making a lot of noise here? Sorry. I'm an audio professional. I get annoyed. No, that's much better. Somebody set out to visit Lewis at his house, and upon arriving, discovered that Lewis wasn't in. And Mrs. Moore obligingly said to this visitor, "Oh, go over to Long Crendon. There's another one just like him there." Now, Long Crendon was the village 15 miles away, and the one living there who was just like him was Owen Barfield. Now, to Mrs. Moore, who was not an intellectual of any stripe, C.S. Lewis and Owen Barfield may have seemed just like two peas in a pod. They were both deeply committed to intellectual life. They were both evidently, obviously, out of sync with conventions of modern and modernizing life, but they were not, by a long shot, just like each other. They were, however, beneficiaries of a rich and long friendship. It was a literary friendship, but it was more than that. They read Dante and Homer and other classic works of literature together and discussed them. But it was, more accurately, a friendship of two men who, in a sense, were also literary. They enjoyed together with the company of others annual spring walking tours and aimless or more aimless conversations. In 1930, Barfield moved from Oxford, and from that time until Lewis's death in 1963, they got together six or seven times a year and remained close. Later in life, Barfield served as Lewis's solicitor. He actually, the middle part of his life, worked in a law firm. And Barfield assisted Lewis in setting up a mechanism for the distribution of charitable gifts. Barfield tells a story about how Lewis was very generous and people would write him, ask him for money, and he'd just give money away. Barfield helped regularize that a little bit. The early years of their friendship were profoundly formative for both men intellectually, probably more so for Lewis than for Barfield. They were exactly the same age. They were both born in 1898. Both sons of solicitors, Barfield from London, Lewis from Belfast. They both won scholarships to Oxford in 1916, but didn't meet until 1919, as both of them were involved in military service in the First World War. Lewis was destined to spend his entire career in the academy. Barfield, upon completing undergraduate studies in 1921, pursued intellectual work as an amateur. In 1925, his first published book was a fairy story called The Silver Trumpet. It's currently out of print, but it's coming back in print sometime this year. I've not read it. But I know that it's a book that was loved by the children of J.R.R. Tolkien, and some people think that Tolkien's decision to write The Hobbit and continue to satisfy the thirst of his children for good fairy stories may have had something to do with Barfield lighting that fuse. He was a remarkable self-motivated thinker. In 1926, his first academic work or scholarly work was published, History in English Words. 2 years later, a book called Poetic Diction was released, a book based on his B-Lit thesis. And both of these early books expressed ideas about language, about imagination, and about the nature of meaning that occupied Barfield throughout his life. In fact, some people think you can see the germ of all of his ideas in these first two books. Barfield used to say that he didn't really change much. Lewis changed a lot, developed as a thinker. Barfield kept pursuing deeper and deeper ideas he'd started with in his 20s. Now, during this period, as he was releasing those first two scholarly books, between 1925 and 1930, Barfield and Lewis had an ongoing series of letters and conversations, mostly letters, which were eventually dubbed the Great War. In fact, there's a book called C.S. Lewis's Great War with Owen Barfield, and it sounds like it was a kind of knockdown, drag-out argument, but it was actually more like war games, someone has said. There's a sense in which they're kind of testing each other and testing each other's ideas and testing their own ideas, testing their own faculty for argument, as well as testing a particular frontiers of concerns. It was a friendly but consistently intense argument about the relationship between imagination and truth, one of the big themes happening there. Now, this happened before Lewis's conversion to Christianity. And I'd heard about this debate, and I always thought it had something to do with Lewis's commitment to Orthodox Christianity and Barfield's commitment to a less than Orthodox philosophical system called anthroposophy, which he adopted early in life and was committed to throughout his life. I guess it would be fair to call anthroposophy a Christian heresy. And I always thought that the debate between them had something to do with this, but it had very little to do with that because Lewis wasn't even a Christian. In fact, at the time, Barfield was probably closer to Orthodox Christian thought than Lewis was. The questions raised by Barfield in those letters and in earlier conversations did have a profound effect in Lewis's thinking and on his life, and it's an effect that may have been deeper than either man recognized. In an off-cited passage from his spiritual autobiography, Surprised by Joy, Lewis describes the kind of friendship that he and Barfield had. And if you know anything about Lewis and Barfield, this is probably the paragraph that you know from Surprised by Joy. Lewis had explained his relationship with his friend, longtime friend Arthur Greaves, whom he'd known since he was 16 years old. And he described Greaves as the first friend, kind of the archetype of the first friend, capital F, capital F. The alter ego, Lewis wrote, the man who first reveals to you that you are not alone in the world by turning out beyond hope to share all your most secret delights. Barfield was, by contrast, the archetypal second friend. And here's how Lewis described that character. The second friend is the man who disagrees with you about everything. He's not so much the alter ego as the anti-self. Of course he shares your interests, otherwise he would not become your friend at all. But he's approached them all at a different angle. He's read all the right books, but has got the wrong thing out of every one. It is as if he spoke your language but mispronounces it. It is, how can he be so nearly right and yet invariably just not right? When you set out to correct his heresies, you find that he, forsooth, has decided to correct yours. And then you go at it hammer and tongs, far into the night, night after night, or walking through fine country that neither gives a glance to, each learning the weight of the other's punches, and often more likely mutually respectful enemies than friends. Actually, though it never seems so at the time, you modify one another's thought. Out of this perpetual dogfight, a community of mind and deep affection emerge. But I think he changed me a good deal more than I him. Most scholars who know their work well agree that that's probably true. And as a dabbler in this work, it seems to me to be the case also. Barfield, however, later asked this more than once, what am I supposed to have taught him? He continues to deny everything I say. And even after Lewis's death, Barfield felt this way. But in fact, I think the trajectory of Lewis's thinking was profoundly shaped by Barfield's friendship with him. They continued to disagree about some things, but their agreements were formative. And as Barfield once put it, in our agreements, we always, both of us, were arguing for truth, not for victory, and arguing for truth, not for comfort. It's a wonderful way to have an intellectual friendship. When Barfield and Lewis met, Lewis was still extremely hostile, not just to Christianity, but to supernaturalism. He was guilty of that condition he later called chronological snobbery, the idea that old ideas were outdated and not worthy of serious consideration by sophisticated thinkers. As Lewis himself described this condition, it was, quote, the uncritical acceptance of the intellectual climate common to our own age, and the assumption that whatever has gone out of date is on that account discredited, close quote. Lewis's refusal to entertain supernaturalism was in part a function of this prejudice, this chronological snobbery, and it was Barfield as much as anyone else that cured him of this flawed and foolish prejudice. Not only did that leave room for Lewis to consider the claims of the gospel, but later in life, writing as an apologist, Lewis had a deep recognition of how chronological snobbery posed an obstacle, not just to Christian belief, but to serious thought of any kind. And I'll look at some of the passages in his book that describe this in a little bit, in a few moments. Barfield, meanwhile, from the writing of his first scholarly book, History in English Words, which was the first time I had actually read him, and I have an old paperback edition of it that cost $1.95, which shows how long I had this book, I think. Barfield called attention to how the dominant assumptions and intuitions of an era shape the thinking of its members, how imagining shapes believing. Chronological snobbery is just one instance of how a deeply held assumption, something we're not even aware that we are assuming, can influence the conclusions that we allow ourselves to come to. What we think is shaped by how we think, by what we attend to without awareness as we think. In the late 1970s, Nobel laureate Saul Bellow, who was a great admirer of Owen Barfield, wrote this: "We are well supplied with interesting writers, but Owen Barfield is not content to be merely interesting. His ambition is to set us free. Free from what? From the prison we have made for ourselves by our ways of knowing. Our limited and false habits of thought," and that phrase, habits of thought, is one that shows up a lot in Barfield. "Our common sense," by this, Bellow means what sorts of things that we just assume, everyone assumes. But it turns out that often those assumptions are part of the cultural moment that we're captive to. Bellow goes on, "These false habits of thought," Barfield convincingly argues, "have produced a world of outsides with no insides to them, a brittle surface world, an object world in which we ourselves are mere objects. It is not only what we perceive, but how what we fail to perceive that determines the quality of the world we live in. And what we have collectively chosen not to perceive is the full reality of consciousness." More on this in a minute. "The inside of everything that exists." Barfield called attention to the fact that ideas don't just have consequences, they have antecedents. Our thinking is altered not just because of new arguments, but our thinking is altered because the things we're thinking about are perceived or imagined in new ways. And he once offered this very concrete example. "The changes in our ideas about, say, the economics of transport and commerce over the past several centuries, have no doubt resulted in part from the impact of idea upon idea. But another cause of these changes lies in the altered nature of transport and commerce themselves. That is, the thing about which we form ideas has evolved. Therefore," he would go on, "the ideas that we have about them have changed, often very subtly. Our ideas about a very practical matter, the economics of transport, are affected by a change in consciousness, that is, a change in the assumptions that we have about the thing as we perceive it. And that, in turn, has evolved because the shape of our experience has reordered our perception." This complex interaction and subtle interaction between experience, perception, imagination, and thought, this dynamic interaction between the inner world of thinking and the outer world of life in the world. It's developed in very complex ways in Barfield's thought, but it is one of the ways in which he influenced Lewis. And the rejection of chronological snobbery was just one case in point of that influence. And before looking more at Lewis's writings that reflect this, I want to say just a few more things about the central concerns in Barfield's own work. Barfield, like Lewis, like all right-thinking young university students in the early 20th century, Barfield came of age intellectually as a materialist. He assumed that matter and energy were the fundamental realities in the universe. The condition probably hasn't changed. In fact, most young people at this university are probably materialists. They may not realize it, but I'm sure that's very common. Human consciousness, reason, and any sense of spirituality were dismissed as byproducts of electrochemical processes. But Barfield, despite his commitment intellectually to materialism, was haunted by the experience of meaning in poetry. Meaning which seemed so compelling, it seemed to bear witness to something beyond matter at the heart of things. He couldn't explain it based on his materialistic assumptions. It was the experience of works of imagination, despite the spirit of the age, that rendered materialism increasingly implausible to it. And that experience not only caused Barfield to recognize the reality of mind or spirit as something beyond matter, it also encouraged him to reflect on why earlier ages seemed to find it much less difficult to assume the reality of the spiritual than did modern men and women. Specifically, men and women living in the wake of the Enlightenment and the so-called scientific revolution. And this led to a central idea in his thinking, the idea of the evolution of consciousness, the recognition of the fact that how the world has been perceived in any given era is not simply the product of explicitly held beliefs arrived at by argument, by reasoning, but was shaped by the deep understanding of things intuitively perceived by what Richard Weaver once called our metaphysical dream of the world. In 1961, Barfield wrote one of the few pieces he ever wrote for a more popular audience. Unlike Lewis, he tended to write more arcane books. And this was an article published in the Saturday Evening Post, which I was kind of shocked to learn he'd written for that venerable old middle American institution, best known today possibly for its covers painted by Norman Rockwell. Barfield's, I didn't associate Norman Rockwell and Owen Barfield in the same place. Barfield's article was called The Rediscovery of Meaning, and it's been reprinted. I think there was one copy out there. There's an anthology of Barfield's shorter writings called The Rediscovery of Meaning that has been republished recently. And it's actually a really good introduction, and it's it's entirely understandable because it was written for the Saturday Evening Post and not for some esoteric academic journal. Barfield reflected in that article on the widespread unease in the mid-20th century, an unease that he described as a growing general sense of meaninglessness. And he insisted that this foreboding nihilism had definite historical causes. Here's what he said in one of the first paragraphs in that article. Most people are well aware that with the advent of the scientific revolution about 300 years ago, the mind of man began to relate itself to the world around it in an entirely new way. The habit, remember called attention to that use in the habits of thought or habits of thinking, habits of mind. The habit then first arose of meticulously observing the facts of nature and systematically interpreting them in terms of physical cause and effect. And this habit has been growing ever since with incalculable and largely beneficial results for the accumulation of practical knowledge or knowledge enabling the manipulation of nature. What is less clearly realized is the precise nature and significance of a certain further step which was taken in the 19th century. It was then that this habitual practice in the pursuit of knowledge, of looking at physical cause and effect, exclusively, was formulated as a dogma under the name of the positive philosophy, or positivism. It's astonishing that an article on positivism is in the Saturday Evening Post in the 1960s. I'm not sure it's an issue that's sold out at the newsstands. Barfield went on to explain that positivism is just another name for materialism, an assumption that everything is simply matter. And the habit of attending to physical cause and effect, that is, the habit of inattentiveness to any realities beyond physical cause and effect, was superseded by an assumption. Now, follow this. We have the habit of just paying attention to how things work physically, because we can do things with them. We can make things happen. We can blow things up. Okay? We can make things. Attending to something beyond it, the meaning of the thing, what might the thing mean? How might the meaning of the thing tie to spiritual realities? We weren't attending to that. We weren't in the habit of attending to that. From that inattentiveness, Barfield says, an assumption arose, sometimes explicitly stated, sometimes more implicit, quote, that scientific attention to the meaning as distinct from the causes of phenomena was impossible. That is, we can't attend to meaning. We know how procreation works physically, but we can't attend to its having any kind of meaning, to use an example from biology. Scientific attention to the meaning of phenomena was impossible, even if, which was considered improbable, there was anything to attend to. The meaning of a process is the inner being which the process expresses. The denial of any such inner being to the processes of nature leads inevitably to the denial of it in man himself. 1961, that Barfield is proclaiming this. And he went on to explain in this essay that for a long time, a sort of dualistic equilibrium was possible. The world of the senses, the world that was known by scientific knowledge, was acknowledged to be a mechanical realm. It was devoid of meaning. But we still had the inner life of human beings, which was still a zone of meaning and purpose. And we could preserve this kind of detente. We'll let the scientists explain the outer world, the world of space and time and matter and motion. And we'll let the theologians and pastors talk about the inner life. Or the psychiatrist, maybe. But that was, he claimed, an uneasy state of affairs that couldn't long be sustained. If you're going to deny meaning in one place, you end up denying it in the other. And the latter part of Barfield's article described various 19th century thinkers who resisted this mechanistic and dualistic model. And that's, I think, the most interesting part of the essay, is that not everybody went along with this, even in the 18th and 19th century. There were a lot of thinkers who resisted this and saw where it was headed. Among them, Goethe, who's best known for his poetry and plays, but was also a botanist, and Samuel Taylor Coleridge, who wrote a lot about imagination. We tend to think of Goethe today just as a poet or philosopher. In his day, he was known as a serious man of science. He wrote several important works on the structure of biological organisms. He wrote works on color theory. And Goethe believed that scientists should attend to the qualities of the objects they're observing, not just the quantities, not just the measurable, not just the stuff you can put in a spreadsheet or put on a chart or a graph. The things that, from the time of Galileo, scientists have said, we don't have anything to do with things like color or smell, how things smell. We want quantifiable data about things. Color and smell are things in the subjective realm, have nothing to do with this. But what Goethe was asking is, well, what if the way that things appeal to our imagination actually has scientific consequences? This is an idea that wasn't useful. It's hard to get patents from it. Hard to make things blow up with that idea, I think. Science, Goethe believed, and others, called for an engagement with the meaning of things in creation, not simply a detached analysis of things for the sake of control. Now, this idea that the things of creation have meaningful qualities and not just useful quantities reminds me of a famous passage in which Lewis described how his imagination was baptized when, in the second half of his teens, he read a book called Phantastes by the 19th century Scottish writer George MacDonald. And in Surprised by Joy, Lewis explains how his early life had been haunted by powerful fugitive sensations of longing and beauty, experiences which he labels joy, similar to what German romantics would have called Sehnsucht, or learning, or yearning. And the effect that Phantasies had upon him was somehow to make these moments less transitory. And here's how Lewis describes it. Up till now, each visitation of joy had left the common world momentarily a desert. Even when real clouds or trees had been the material of the vision, they had been so only by reminding me of another world, and I didn't like the return to ours. But now, as I read Phantasties, I saw the bright shadow coming out of the book into the real world and resting there, transforming all common things and yet itself unchanged. Or more accurately, I saw the common things drawn into the bright shadow. In the depth of my disgraces, in the then invincible ignorance of my intellect, all this was given me without asking, without even consent. That night my imagination was in a certain sense baptized. The rest of me not unnaturally took longer. I had not the faintest notion what I'd left myself in for by buying Phantasties. Now, for Lewis, this was an important early experience in his pilgrimage to Christian belief, but as he indicated, it was only a first step. For some time, he was still in the grip of the powerful assumptions of modern culture, and it was Barfield who, I think, encouraged him to break free from his cultural captivity, to repent of his chronological snobbery, which was another essential step in his conversion. One of the reasons Lewis may have been critical of Barfield's idea of the evolution of consciousness, which is one of the things they argued about, is that Lewis came to regard the idea of evolution as such, evolution with a capital E, not just the evolution of species, not just any specific instance of evolution. Lewis regarded the idea of evolution as such as one of the disorienting myths of modern culture. Having learned from Barfield how certain ages become captive to certain assumptions about reality, he was uneasy with the use of the idea of evolution to describe a process that, because he believed that the idea of evolution itself was the source of our most fatal captivity. And I want to draw your attention here to his essay, The Funeral of a Great Myth. And in that essay, which I think is a seminal work of his, he discusses the idea of evolution or development or emergence, all three of which he lists with capital letters. He describes this idea as the great myth of the 19th and early 20th century. Having first turned what was a theory of change into a theory of improvement, and that's a critical step. You see how there have been biological changes. The assertion is it's an improvement. Well, why would the change necessarily be an improvement? Having first turned what was a theory of change into a theory of improvement, it then makes this a cosmic theory. Not merely terrestrial organisms, but everything is moving upwards and onwards. Reason has evolved out of instinct, virtue out of complexes, poetry out of erotic howls and grunts, civilization out of savagery, the organic out of the inorganic, the solar system out of some sidereal soup or traffic block. And conversely, reason, virtue, art, and civilization, as we now know them, are only the crude or embryonic beginnings of far better things. Perhaps deity itself in the remote future. For in the myth, and he says this is the modern myth, evolution, as the myth understands it, is the formula of all existence. To exist means to be moving from the status of almost zero to the status of almost infinity. To those brought up on the myth, nothing seems more normal, more natural, more plausible than that chaos should turn into order, that death should turn into life, that ignorance should turn into knowledge. And with this, we reach the full-blown myth. It is one of the most moving and satisfying world dramas which has ever been imagined. He thinks it's false, but it's a great story. Now, what Lewis dubs as a myth was not a conclusion or a premise in an argument. It doesn't work as explicitly as that. In the imaginative setting within which arguments are made, it is, rather, the imaginative setting in which arguments are made. Even though Lewis was profoundly skeptical of Barfield's idea about the evolution of consciousness, he seems in this essay and elsewhere to accept the practical consequences of part of Barfield's claim. Lewis was never comfortable with how Barfield expressed his understanding of the relationship between imagination and truth. But throughout his Barfield called the consciousness of an era, can direct our thinking in profound ways. Lewis once observed that if our thinking is ever true, then the metaphors by which we think must have been good metaphors. He argued, for example, the likenesses traditionally asserted between goodness and light, between evil and darkness, or between breath and spirit are not arbitrary or fanciful, but representative of some likeness that's actually embedded in the order of creation. So our thinking about such things is good because we're using good metaphors. I think that that attentiveness to the power of metaphor to shape the pursuit of truth is a concern that he developed, in part, at least, from his interaction with Owen Barfield. Now, I want to add, at this moment, a note of humble caution about this lecture. As I was preparing it, I read in a book by R.J. Riley this warning, quote, "Barfield's work will never be popular reading, though it is possible that someone will isolate certain aspects of his work, his view of the human imagination perhaps, and popularize it by distorting it." And later, Riley concludes, "If that occurs, his popularity will come at great cost." Well, that sobering whipcrack has haunted me for some time, and I don't expect that this brief outing with Lewis and Barfield will make any of us here experts on Barfield. I think his writing is worthy of many, many hours of thoughtful reflection, and hope that in a very tentative way, and in a way in which I'm probably distorting key aspects of his work by trying to popularize it and summarize it, but I hope that give you at least a passing glimpse of the way that his ideas influence a very good friend. Now, with that Surgeon General's warning having been read, let me go on. C.S. Lewis's essay, "The World's Last Night," is another essay in which he shows how the deep assumptions held in a historical period can shape the thinking and distort our thinking. "The World's Last Night" addresses some of the thoughts, quote, "that may deter modern man from a firm belief in or due attention to the return or second coming of the Savior." I don't know if many people know about this essay, but it's about why the second coming is an important doctrine for us to emphasize. And one of the main reasons it seems unattractive or implausible, he argues, to modern men and women, is because it conflicts with that great modern myth of evolution. We've been taught to think of the world as something that grows slowly toward perfection, something that progresses or evolves. Christian apocalyptic offers us no such hope. It does not even foretell, which would be more tolerable to our habits of thought, a gradual decay. It foretells a sudden, violent end imposed from without, an extinguisher popped under the candle, a brick flung at the gramophone, a curtain rung down on the play. Halt! And Lewis later says in this essay, "The doctrine of the second coming, then, is not to be rejected because it conflicts with our favorite modern mythology. It is, for that very reason, to be the more valued and made more frequently the subject of meditation. It is the medicine our condition especially needs." Now, one of my favorite instances of Lewis's recognition of the power of the imagination to shape thinking, the power, if you will, in this case, inappropriate metaphors to shape our consciousness, comes from an address he gave in 1954. It's an address he gave when he assumed the chair of medieval and Renaissance studies at Cambridge. And Lewis pointed to an example when he suggested that the Industrial Revolution stimulated a cultural dynamic that radically distinguishes modern culture from all earlier times. He says, "Between Jane Austen and us, but not between her and Shakespeare, Chaucer, Alfred, Virgil, Homer, or the Pharaohs, comes the birth of the machines. And that birth," Lewis argued, "is parallel to the great changes by which we divide epochs of prehistory. This is on a level with the change from stone to bronze or from a pastoral to an agricultural economy. It alters man's place in nature." And I think you could take that. Our place in nature has been altered because of the presence of technology. And as a result of that, our thinking about reality has been profoundly affected. Now, he's not interested in the social or political changes that came in the wake of this new relationship to nature. He's interested in the effect on the modern imagination. And here's a passage that's often quoted. How has it come about that we use the highly emotive word stagnation with all its malodorous and malarial overtones for what other ages would have called permanence? Why does the word primitive at once suggest to us clumsiness, inefficiency, barbarity? There's still primitive Baptist churches, right? That doesn't mean that they're clumsy and primitive. Barbarous means that they're returning to the font, to the origins. Why does latest in advertisements mean best? He says, I submit what has happened, what has imposed this climate of opinion so firmly on the human mind is a new archetypal image. It's the image of old machines being superseded by new and better ones. For in the world of machines, the new most often really is better, and the primitive really is clumsy. Lewis went on to argue that this mentality, the mentality that assumed that new was better, was evidence of an approach to life, quote, that separates us most sharply from our ancestors, and whose absence would strike us as most alien if we could return to their world. Conversely, our assumption that everything is provisional and soon to be superseded, that the attainment of goods we have never yet had, rather than the defense of the conservation of those we have already, is the cardinal business of life, would most shock and bewilder them if they could visit ours. And he sums this change up by announcing, dramatically, I conclude that it really is the greatest change in the history of Western man. It's a fascinating argument. And I think that this is a change in what Barfield would call consciousness. It's not a conclusion deduced from an argument. It's an intuition, a myth, if you will, received by the imagination, which then affects our thinking by rendering us likely to assume that the inferiority and even irrelevance of old things, the omnipresence of machines, reconfigures our assumptions about human well-being. By calling into question the age-old assumption that there are permanent things around which well-lived life ought to be ordered, the existence of the creator of those permanent things also becomes less plausible. The psalmist's conviction that God laid the foundations of the earth which cannot be moved is less comforting and commanding if permanence is regarded as stagnation. In a little-known essay called Modern Man and His Categories of Thought, which was written in 1946, it's in that little-known anthology Present Concerns, Lewis similarly examined ways in which the assumptions of our contemporaries differ radically from those to whom the gospel was first preached. He says the early missionaries preached to three sorts of men, to Jews, to Judaizing Gentiles, and to pagans. In all three classes, they could count on certain predispositions which we cannot count on in our audience. All three classes believed in the supernatural. All three were conscious of sin and feared divine judgment. And they all believed that the world had once been better than it was now. The Jewish doctrine of the fall, the Stoic conception of the Golden Age, the common pagan reference for heroes, for ancestors, and ancient lawgivers were in this respect more or less agreed. So three, what he calls predispositions, three, again, deeply held assumptions about reality. Belief in the supernatural, belief in and fear of divine judgment, and belief the world had once been better than it was now. The world which we must try to convert shares none of those predispositions, he says. In the last 100 years, the public mind has been radically altered. And then he goes on to enumerate ways in which our predispositions have changed. First, he talks about changes that have happened because of the shift in the structure of education, specifically the decline in the study of classics. He says, in a culture in which education involved the reading of old books, it was natural to men so trained to believe that valuable truth could still be found in an ancient book. It's interesting how that idea is increasingly implausible in our culture. We want the latest book on a subject, not an old book. The old book is read for interesting historical or academic purposes. The idea that we could find the greatest wisdom in an old book is not as plausible to us. It was natural to men so educated, he says, for them to reverence tradition. Values quite different from those of modern industrial civilization were constantly present to their minds. Even where Christian belief was rejected, there was still a standard against which contemporary ideals could be judged. The effect of removing this education has been to isolate the mind in its own age, to give it, in relation to time, that disease which, in relation to space, we call provincialism. The mere fact that St. Paul wrote so long ago is, to a modern man, presumptive evidence against his having uttered important truths. The tactics of the enemy in this matter are simple and can be found in any military textbook. Before attacking a regiment, you must try, if you can, to cut it off from the regiments on each side. Interesting that he suggests that this has a satanic cause, not simply sociology or the development of social trends. He also identifies a predisposition toward practicality. Man is becoming as narrowly practical as the irrational animals. In lecturing to popular audiences, I've repeatedly found it almost impossible to make them understand that I recommend Christianity because I thought its affirmations to be objectively true. They're simply not interested in the question of truth or falsehood. They only want to know if it will be comforting or inspiring or socially useful. Closely connected with this inhuman practicality is an indifference to and contempt of dogma. The popular point of view is unconsciously syncretistic. It's widely believed that all religions really mean the same thing. Towards the end of this essay, you know, it's interesting because it's an essay, it sounds like it's an essay written to help people doing evangelism to contextualize their message in this new setting. When it gets to the end of the essay, he's not quite sure what to do about this. In fact, he says, one way of summarizing the situation would be to say, I sometimes wonder whether we shall not have to reconvert men to real paganism as a preliminary to converting them to Christianity. If they were Stoics, Orphics, Mithraists, or better still, peasants worshiping the earth, our task might be easier. That is why I do not regard contemporary paganisms as a wholly bad symptom. He offered a very similar sentiment in an essay called Is Theism Important? When grave persons express their fear that England is relapsing into paganism, I am tempted to reply, would that she were. For I do not think it at all likely that we shall ever see Parliament opened by the slaughtering of a garlanded white bull in the House of Lords, or cabinet ministers leaving sandwiches in Hyde Park as an offering for the dryads. If such a state of affairs came about, then the Christian apologist would have something to work on. For a pagan, as history shows, is a man eminently convertible to Christianity. He is essentially the pre-Christian or sub-Christian religious man. The post-Christian man of our day differs from him as much as a divorcee differs from a virgin. The Christian and the pagan have much more in common with one another than either has with the writers of the New Statesman. And those writers would, of course, agree with me. Now, in both of these essays, Lewis is identifying a set of predispositions that render the gospel implausible to modern men and women. They're not really truth claims that are amenable to debate. They live at the level of myth, imagination, intuition. It's a modern consciousness that regards God and truth and history radically different from a pre-modern consciousness. And I think that readers of Lewis who see this rightly understand that he acquired some of this understanding from Owen Barfield. Granted, his differences with Barfield on what this meant and how it took shape were important, but I think he did attend to this the way he did because of the relationship he had with Barfield. I want to just mention briefly, I don't have time to look at it in context, my favorite book by Lewis is The Abolition of Man. I think it's his most important work. And that's one of the few instances where he explicitly acknowledges some of the intellectual ideas with which Barfield had been associated. And it's in a section, there's a long paragraph in the last chapter where he likens contemporary pursuit of science and technology to the pursuit of magic in the 16th and 17th centuries. And I'll just read a short section of this. The serious magical endeavor and the serious scientific endeavor are twins. One was sickly and died, the other strong and throve, but they were twins. They were born of the same impulse. I allow that some of the early scientists were actuated by a pure love of knowledge. But if we consider the temper of that age as a whole, we can discern the impulse of which I speak. There's something which unites magic and applied science, while separating both from the wisdom of earlier ages. For the wise men of old, the cardinal problem had been how to conform the soul to reality. And the solution had been knowledge, self-discipline, and virtue. For magic and applied science alike, the problem is how to subdue reality to the wishes of men. And then later he goes on to say that science, the solution for this will have to come from within science itself. He says, it may be going too far to say that the modern scientific movement was tainted from its birth, but I think it would be true to say that it was born in an unhealthy neighborhood and at an inauspicious hour. Its triumphs may have been too rapid and purchased at too high a price. Reconsideration and something like repentance may be required. And then as he's searching for an alternate, how could we reimagine how science should proceed? And one of the most tentative, Lewis isn't known for having really tentative and fragile statements. Is it possible to imagine a new natural philosophy, continually conscious that the, quote, natural object produced by analysis and abstraction is not reality but only a view, and always correcting the abstraction? I hardly know what I'm asking for. I hear rumors that Goethe's approach to nature deserves fuller consideration, that even Dr. Steiner, and here he's referring to Rudolf Steiner, the founder of anthroposophy, that even Dr. Steiner may have seen something that orthodox researchers have missed. It's this really interesting little nod toward Barfield, both of them concerned about the way in which modern science had corrupted our understanding of reality by making us all into materialists or practical materialists. And as he's looking around for a way out of this, he turns to the kinds of concerns that Barfield had been pursuing. A few words in closing. Barfield dedicated his second major book, Poetic Diction, to C.S. Lewis. If you have an early edition of the book, you'll see it's actually dedicated to Clive Hamilton. Clive Hamilton was the pseudonym that Lewis was using at the time. And it included a quotation from William Blake, "Opposition is true friendship." In the second edition, Lewis's real name is cited in the dedication, and in the preface, Barfield explains that Lewis had abandoned the pen name Clive Hamilton shortly after Poetic Diction was published. "I have now substituted his true name, to which his publications in many varied fields have since lent so much distinction. I do this rather in the interest of accuracy than as claiming any reflected share in that distinction. But I also grasp with both hands so opportune an occasion of rededicating this book in celebration of nearly half a lifetime's priceless friendship." Lewis similarly dedicated one of his first major works, The Allegory of Love, to Barfield and wrote him as identified him as wisest and best of my unofficial teachers. Many years later, one of Lewis's former pupils, in a conversation with Barfield, said, quote, that at that time there were two schools of thought in Oxford, one of which held that there really was a man called Owen Barfield who had written a book called Poetic Diction, and the others who held that it was simply a name invented by Lewis when he wanted to put forward some idea he didn't want to take full responsibility for. That shows the kind of grudging influence that even Lewis himself recognized. Now, in reading a lot of Barfield's work in preparation for this talk, I was mindful not only of the ways in which he'd influenced Lewis, whether or not Lewis acknowledged it or welcomed it, but of ways in which Barfield's radical ideas anticipated or echoed the thinking of many subsequent thinkers. For example, consider this passage from the work of Reformed theologian Colin Gunton, a 1985 book called Enlightenment and Alienation. "In our desire to impose form on the world and our lives, we have lost the capacity to see the form that is there. And in that lies not liberation but alienation, the cutting off from things as they really are." And later in that book, Gunton commends the thinking of Samuel Taylor Coleridge, as does Barfield in many places. He's one of Barfield's histories, for his rehabilitation of the idea of imagination. Let me read what Gunton says. "There are several formulations of his views, and it's impossible to be absolutely clear what he meant," and Coleridge was a difficult writer, "but the general drift is clear. He wished to argue that there is a use of the imagination which is not merely fanciful, but enables us to come into some kind of contact with what is really there. What is really there? Imagination properly conceived helps us to mediate between passive sense and active intellect. Like Barfield, Colin Gutton believed that science has lost sight of what is really there in the things of creation, but that the habit of detached and reductionistic and utilitarian observation has eclipsed what is really there. Gutton also praised the insight of Michael Polanyi, whose works in philosophy of science interested Barfield, and whose own work has been compared to some of Barfield's. Gutton suggests that Polanyi's view of knowledge is one of a stumbling discovery rather than the quest for certainty, a liberation from the aspiration to omniscience. If we renounce the quest for omniscience and absolute control that has so alienated modern culture from its world, we are not renouncing the modern scientific quest to understand. The science of which Polanyi is speaking is based upon our community with and indwelling within, not our disembodied contemplation of the real universe of which we are a part. And I think if, for those of you who know Polanyi and this idea of indwelling, it sounds very similar to Barfield's idea about participation, that we know as participants within creation, not as detached observers. There are great resonances in these reflections with the insights of Owen Barfield, and as Barfield developed his own insights about perception, imagination, and our engagement with creation in the 1920s and 30s and on, I think it's safe to say that there were few Orthodox Christian theologians whose work could reinforce what he intuitively knew, what he was intuiting about how we intuit, how we know and what we know. And that may account in part for his attraction to the thought of Rudolf Steiner and the body of ideas called anthroposophy, which are beyond the bounds of Christian orthodoxy. Today, there are countless Orthodox Christian thinkers who are challenging Enlightenment assumptions about the nature of knowledge. Many of them have been nourished by the remarkable recovery of pre-modern theology from both patristic and medieval sources, work in Christian metaphysics that stresses the principle of relationality within all of creation, as well as related work in Trinitarian theology, has possibilities for development along lines that I think resonate with Barfield's concerns. What I'm saying here is that we're living in a time when Christian thinkers can pursue the consequences of Barfield's genius more thoroughly than many of his contemporaries did, and I think more than Lewis did. In an interview with him shortly before his death in 1997, Barfield said he doubted whether his work would be fully appreciated for at least 50 years. It's fascinating to reflect on how God has used and may continue to use the friendship of these two remarkable men. Barfield was surely instrumental in Lewis's conversion. Lewis's writing has in turn been instrumental in encouraging the faith of countless Christians who've come of age in a time when the nihilistic consequences of the materialism that he and Barfield once embraced but came to despise is now more entrenched in our institutions than ever. Our laws and our public life regularly deny or disregard the inherent meaningfulness in creation. So we desperately need a revolution in thinking about thinking. The resources for such a recovery of sanity are much more plentiful now, much more accessible now than they have been in many lifetimes, if only we have the wisdom and courage to appropriate them. So I'm hopeful that the work that's been done by the kinds of theologians I alluded to, work in metaphysics, work in epistemology, work on Trinitarian theology like Colin Gutton's work in theology of creation, which seems to present, again, a more compatible, something more compatible with the kinds of insights that Barfield had. Not everything, to be sure, but some key ideas that are present there. I think that there's a possibility for a real counterattack against Enlightenment reductionism. And it's encouraging at this time to see that Owen Barfield's grandson, Owen Barfield, is very active in bringing a lot of his grandfather's work back into print. I mentioned The Silver Trumpet coming back into print soon, and a number of his other books are also. So I will close there. Thank you for your patience, and I hope this is a useful introduction. I think one book that I would recommend, if you can find a copy, I think it may be out of print. There's one of the most accessible works by Barfield is a collection of papers he gave about C.S. Lewis, and particularly for those of you who know and love Lewis's work. It was called Owen Barfield on C.S. Lewis. It was edited by G.B. Tennyson. It was published, I think, originally by Ohio State University Press. I think it's out of print now, but I think, again, that's one of the things that is coming back in print soon. Thank you very much.
do have a few minutes for some Q&A. If anybody has any questions they'd like to ask Ken, anything that he's mentioned or anything else that's on your mind related to these issues. It's always time to break the ice here. Okay. Yes, sir.
I just think it's interesting around that same time in Britain you have Eliot, who writes in his essay towards the definition of culture about
right.
being friends with people outside of your comfort zone. You have Lewis, who is friends with Barfield. And then you have Chesterton, who was not friends with Wells, but certainly had a deep respect for Wells, who he disagreed with so strongly. Do you have any idea what would have influenced those group of men? They all are in that same kind of time period and location, and they all have a deep respect for people of an opposite viewpoint and are deeply influenced by them. How is that? Can you isolate where that may have been?
Yeah, well, I think I think that one of the differences between their time and ours was ours has become much more tribal and partisan. I don't think we have a sense of obligation or responsibility for the shaping of a common culture the way they still had it. I think that a variety of things have happened in the intervening period. I mean, I think the idea of a common culture has come to be seen in the late 20th century as a source of oppression, inevitable oppression, because a culture is an authoritative way of life. And as particularly after the 1960s, modern Western people were more and more suspicious of authority, in some instances because of what were seen as gross violations of authority, although not grosser than many in the past have been. But I think that the idea of a shared culture is, and the idea of pursuing a common good rooted in the good, rooted in some transcendent good, I think that that's less and less the case. And I think a lot of Christian intellectuals have become more defensive, have become, in a sense, mere apologists, and not cultural thinkers, although there are exceptions to that. I think that's the climate for all of those men that you mentioned was still the idea, and you feel that very strongly when you're reading Eliot, and he has no problem with making pretty strong claims about the necessity of Christian ideas being a central factor in Western culture and particularly in national life in Great Britain. It's easier to do if you have an established church behind you, but I'm not sure how much the established church was a theological force when Eliot was actually writing. Americans in particular, I think, have, and a number of people pointed this out in the last 10 or 20 years, we're not really at home with the idea of the public consequences of Christian thought, the truly cultural consequences of Christian thought. A lot of what is presented as cultural engagement is engagement with people in our society about things that are essentially theological or personally spiritual, and not really about cultural things. I saw this when I was at Eternity Magazine in the 80s and tried to move it toward... I told the powers that be there that I wanted a magazine that really was involved in Christian journalism about cultural issues, and after doing it for a year, I found out they didn't like what I was doing. It didn't have enough Bible verses, they said. And what I realized, what they thought I meant was using cultural phenomena as a private theological claim of some kind, rather than actually confronting public issues. Leslie Newbegin comes to mind. His idea, the phrase he uses a lot, the gospel is public truth. And I don't think most American Christians have a great confidence that our theological convictions, the resurrection, the Trinity, the second coming, are truths with public consequences. And for a variety of reasons, we want the public freedom to privately hold such views. but I don't think we've thought through much about a public life. So I think that, again, that was still the idea of a common culture was still a project that was alive and well into the mid-20th century. I think that's part of it.
All right, we have another question. I saw a hand over here. I'm missing somebody. Yes, down here in front of me.
In The Great Divorce, C.S. Lewis described heaven as being solid and hard, like material matter. To what extent do you think the idea of materialism in the culture that Barfield and Lewis subscribed to, or they were influenced by, to what extent do you think that might have informed his choice of making heaven solid?
I don't know that it did. I think the idea there is that he's trying to get across actually a very different idea, which almost the opposite idea that permanent. Well, let's use biblical language. We're going to have resurrection bodies of some kind, spiritual bodies. Is a term that Paul uses in Corinthians, I think. And I think the point he wanted to make is that these are more real, that these are really hyper-real bodies, and that the experience of materiality that we now know is just through a glass darkly. It's a shadow of a fuller reality. So I think there he's trying to make a kind of Platonic point about transcendent realities being more real than the ephemeral realities of our world. Whereas we tend to think of spiritual things as vacuous and fuzzy and flimsy. Spiritual is like, just floats away. And I think you wanted to get the idea of the substantiality of spiritual realities.
There's also a sense that about what you were talking about earlier, about the reality that is really there and our ability to interact with it.
Right.
You speak about the metaphors and stuff.
Yeah.
Whether we're really engaging that reality.
Yeah.
That whole idea that there's this deep reality that's it is there. It's,
right.
It's not like it's not going
right.
to happen at the resurrection.
Right.
It's
right.
already
right.
there.
Right. Right.
And so that's why it's more solid, because
yeah.
it's sort of a metaphor of its reality.
Right.
Its
exactly. Realness. Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. It's Francis Schaeffer used to talk about true truth. I like to use the phrase real reality,
mm-hmm.
that we believe
real
in real
reality.
Also.
Any other questions? Yes.
Alistair McGrath has said about C.S. Lewis that his gift as an apologist is not so much in the strength of his logical arguments, but in his ability to use imagination to, in some sense, make us want to believe what he's trying to convince us of even before we're convinced. And you were saying that maybe we need a revolution in thinking about thinking. Would you also say maybe we need a revolution in imagination about thinking and using our imagination to shape our thinking?
Yeah, I mean, I think that part of it would involve, part of what I'm suggesting would involve a recognition. a recognition that there's not thinking over here and imagination over here. That the thinking always involves acts of imagination. Now Lewis himself gets at that when he talks about imagination is the precondition for truth. I think he says imagination is the organ of meaning and reason is the organ of truth. So, but I think that a lot of the thinkers I alluded to towards the end of my talk have have tried to recover an idea that imagination isn't just a way of kind of dressing up or tarting up, I call it that, arguments. But sometimes that's done. I'm sure there are clergy even now writing sermons, right, to tart them up with imaginative illustration for Sunday morning, for Sunday in Lent, which is now time to do. I think it's that rather than drawing a stark distinction between analytic reason and imagination or intuition, that we need to think of thinking as involving the interaction of all of those things. And there are, again, there are a lot of... One way of thinking about this is to recover what James Peters writes about in his book on the Augustinian ideas of reason, and the title escapes me right now. I think it's the Heart's Reason. I can't remember that title. But his point is that we tend to think of reason as just a kind of an analytic engine, a kind of appliance to process truth claims. Whereas he said that Augustine saw reason, the point of reason is so we'll love the truth, not just know the truth. And so the way we are engaged with the truth, the end of it is never abstract assent, but it's always to love what's true. And there's a book called Imaginative Apologetics. It's an anthology. In fact, Michael Ward has a really good piece on Lewis and imagination in that collection that came out last year, that has some really good essays on the relationship between the role of imagination in the doing of apologetics and theology. So.
Yes, sir.
When you said argument was for the purpose of truth instead of an argument for the purpose of victory, and then what he said about agreeing, people you disagree with it, you honor them. And in my recent listening to Dallas Willard, I've been sort of going through this. Talks on college campuses, and it seems like he had that little bit of magic that he said in one of his talks that rather than being like against them, he was like a fellow traveler,
yeah,
hopefully going to the same place.
Yeah.
Can you think of? I know he recently passed away. Can you think of anyone else that's maybe
who plays that role, that as opposed to a more gladiatorial role that?
Most of the other apologists seem like they're trying to.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I have to confess, I tend to not like public debates between Christians and atheists, for instance, because I always feel it is like being in the Colosseum, you know, and we're not sure who the lions are and who the Christians are here, but we want our side to win. And I think sometimes they're staged almost as pep rallies for believers to see, yeah, our guy beat the whatever out of him. So I think that's. So that's part of what I had in mind, saying that we're tribal and kind of partisan. We want our guy to win, or we want our truth to win. Well, of course we want our truth to win, but it's not our truth. It's God's truth, and it's something that is good for all. Even those who don't confess Christ, it's good for them. So again, part of this gets to... the tendency to think of conversion as a kind of sheer act of will, rather than an act that involves love and reason. Okay, conversion. A lot of revivalism is based on a kind of sales model of evangelism, where the goal is to overcome sales resistance. And we'll do whatever we need to overcome sales resistance, because we really want to get people to commit that act of will. Whether or not their understanding and their affections is tied to it, well, that'll come later. And I think that's a peculiarly modern understanding of what conversion is. I'm not saying these are inauthentic conversions, but I do think that we do tend to focus on volition separated from reason and affection. And so I think that that's And Dallas Willard, I think, does give a good personal instance of someone who loves the truth. He really does love the truth. And I'm not saying people who are more gladiatorial don't love the truth. It's really a question of emphasis. I'm trying to think of other people like him, and nobody's coming to mind. I mean, it takes remarkable gifts to be in that kind of setting and not to adopt the manners of a gladiatorial function and to see it as a common pursuit. And sadly, our media culture offers very few instances where we can acquire that skill, because most talk radio is again that just kind of point counterpoint. Let's destroy our adversaries because it's good for ratings. So,
one more question, yes, ma'am.
I was reading that instead of doing very merely intellectual writing for intellectuals, that C.S. Lewis and each of his different genre did a different genre to make his points.
Right.
And that definitely points to the imagination.
Oh, yeah.
Being used, and I was wondering who influenced him that way.
I think MacDonald and Chesterton. I think Chesterton, I mean, he talks more about MacDonald than I think he does about Chesterton. But I think that, Chesterton wrote as a journalist, not as an academic, and I think that that model influenced him. I think, again, I don't know how tactical Lewis was in that. I don't know how, I think he had, you see his use of metaphor and his use of the way he shapes arguments, even when he's arguing with someone like Barfield. He just has a felicity for finding a metaphor. There's one instance in their correspondence where where Barfield catches him out on something. He's using the metaphor of someone standing in a room, and there's a candle in the room in the wall, and he talks about how he moves further from the wall, and his shadow gets smaller. And Barfield says, no, that's not what happens. When you move closer to the candle, your shadow actually gets larger. This wonderful, great moment where he kind of nodded off, and he came up with what he thought was a great metaphor, but it turned out to be exactly wrong. I think a number of people who I've read point out that, Lewis was nervous about Barfield's claims for imagination being a vehicle for truth, that there are things we can recognize through imaginative experiences without actually arguing or making an argument for. Lewis is very rationalistic in that way, not opposed to imagination. And yet, a number of people pointed out that, and in fact Barfield pointed this out, that his use of imaginative writing, especially in the Narnia books and in Till We Have Faces, which is a myth. He's better at using imagination than he is at theorizing about it. That's kind of what Barfield concluded. Now, again, I find in his comments about imagination, I find often they're very helpful. They don't go quite as far as Barfield does, and what Barfield's suggesting is that Lewis went farther in his use of imagination. He trusts it more in the actual employment of it than he does in his theorizing about it. And there are some really interesting reasons that some of them get to being from Northern Ireland. Some of them are temperamental. I mean, there are some. I came away from doing a lot of reading for this talk with a real appreciation of contours of Lewis's personality and how his personality, because his personality and Barfield's personality were so different, you can begin to see in their exchanges how a great intellect's personalities is still present in how they present things that seem to be impersonal arguments, but the kinds of emphases he has are quite different from the emphases in Barfield. And I think part of that's a function of their own individuality as persons.
Barfield from England?
Barfield was from England. Yeah. I don't want to over-psychologize it. That's above my pay grade. So thanks very much.
Thank you, Ken, so much for coming. We do appreciate it.